So starting last week and then continuing today and maybe for another few weeks, I had in mind to give a series of talks about this Buddhist concept of self, not self. And it's a very central teaching in Buddhism and often somewhat confusing. And I wanted to kind of spend a number of evenings talking about it to get it at different angles, different aspects of it. In the most simplistic and also inaccurate representation of what the Buddha taught, people will say, oh, the Buddha taught that there is no self. Have you heard that? And then there's all these questions people have. Well, you know, how could there be no self? I'm here, and you're there, and, you know, I'm a self, and I've paid a lot of money to my therapist to strengthen my sense of self, and, and now you're telling me that, you know, it was all wasted? And the idea is not, so we'll get to that in a few weeks about what the Buddha actually said about it. But today I'm going to try to avoid the idea of, you know, is there a self or is there not a self, where a self is talked about as a noun. But rather I'm going to talk about selfing, use the word self as a verb, as an activity, where we various ways in which we're involved in manufacturing a sense of self, constructing a sense of self, an idea of self. There's a whole complex of ways in which the mind engages in activity of thought, of beliefs, of feelings, of body, and all kinds of things that come together so that we're constantly kind of recreating, representing ourselves. And one of the ways to use mindfulness meditation is, once you get some modicum of calm, is to turn your attention, not to get further calm, just to get, you know, calm for its own sake, but then calm enough so you can actually start studying how this constructive process, this activity of selfing, arises within us. It's very hard to see in the busyness of daily life how we do it, because it happens very quickly. But sometimes if you sit quietly enough, you can actually kind of watch or notice how this works. To give you one example of how meditation helped me one day see what I was doing, it was a little bit retrospective, but still. And that was when we were still over there in Palo Alto, I was teaching there. I came to a Monday evening to teach, and there was an old friend there who I hadn't seen for many, many, many years. As I walked in, she was there, and it was nice to see her, but it was just literally, you know, 7:30, time to go sit down. So I said a few words back and forth. And then I said to my friend, if you'd come to hear the talk, and I said, oh, I didn't prepare the talk this evening. And then I went and sat. Now, why was that important news to tell my friend? I didn't prepare the talk. Why was that the thing? My friend I hadn't seen for 10 years. Why was, you know, we had a few extensions. Why should I say that particular piece of information? So I said that, and then we went and sat down, and as we were sitting there, it echoed in my head what I just said. It was the last words I'd said before sitting. And I realized that what I was doing was I was protecting myself from being judged. Because if I gave a lousy talk and my friend was there, you know, I wouldn't look very good. So if I said, oh, you know, I didn't prepare my talk, then that would lower the expectation of my friend. And my, you know, and I would be protected a little bit. So that's called selfing in Buddhism. I was kind of involved in this activity of playing the self game, the selfing game. In this case, I was primarily protecting some sense of self, that I was protecting myself from someone else playing the selfing game towards me. And that's how it often plays out also. We do the selfing game so other people can kind of participate in this game that we're playing, this illusion we're playing. We have a way we want to be seen by others, and so we sometimes will talk certain ways, we'll wear clothes a certain ways, we'll act a certain ways to try to get people to see us that way, because that's kind of how we want to be seen, or not be seen, you know, something. So if we look at the issue of self from the point of view of an activity as a verb, then it gets very interesting. And you don't have, then you can easily see, there's selfing going on. There's an activity going on. I don't know if there's a real self or a no self or anything, but I can certainly see that I'm doing this constructive game, this play of creating a sense of self. So there are three primary ways that the Buddha talked about selfing, how this activity of selfing happens. And this repeatedly in the discourses of the Buddha, he falls back on these three. Sometimes it almost seems like a it's very repetitive in the suttas. You see, and their petition I hear is not is kind of because the Buddha put a lot of emphasis on looking and seeing how this functions. And that is the three selfing activities: the activity where we take something as mine. Where we take something as mine. The second one is when we take something as myself. And the third is we take something as my essence, as my soul, as my atta, is the Buddhist word, atta, sometimes translated as self, something with a capital S. But soul, sometimes translated soul, as soul. Usulananda, who's a great Burmese teacher who died recently, he lived here in Half Moon Bay, he translated atta as soul. And that kind of, then you solve some of these problems we have when we translate it as self. So the Buddha said there's mining. Mining is making things into mine. There is myselfing, making something into myself. And then there is souling, or essencing, making something into my essential self. And each of these three corresponds with three kinds of clinging or craving. The first is a craving for possession. The second is a craving, a particular one called conceit. And I'll talk more about it in a few minutes. And the third one is the craving towards views, opinions, philosophies. So they all represent some kind of craving. And so selfing, often behind it, is there's a movement of clinging. We want something to happen. Then we don't want it, but we're kind of, there's a kind of compulsion around, let me be this kind of person. Some people, that kind of clinging to be a certain kind of person is to be in a positive terms, they want to be somebody. Sometimes it takes the form that they want to be nobody. They want to avoid a certain identity. I don't want to do that. I would do anything I can to avoid that view of myself being created into myself internally or externally. A very popular one for some people is we don't want to see ourselves in negative lights. And so certain kind of negative activities of our mind or heart, we don't admit is there. And so we start putting kind of blinders. Oh, that's not me. And we have all these defensive mechanisms to explain how that's not me or do something. Or we hide it. Or there's certain aspects of ourselves that we think somehow are beautiful, but we feel that is not deserved or not proper. It's not so uncommon, and it must be a coincidence, but it's not so uncommon that I talk to Irish Catholics. And it's a common phenomenon in talking to these particular ones I talk to. I'm sure it's not all of them, where feeling meditative joy is not okay. Feeling your joy in meditation is not okay. Because I don't know if I should fill in the blank why, but you know, there's a certain religious view. Some people are shaking their heads, that somehow says it's not okay. And now, on top of that, not only is it not okay to feel meditative joy, but that's also selfish. And your spirit should be out there serving others. Are the Irish Catholics here? Not disparaging anyone necessarily. I love Irish Catholics. I mean, but, they're good people. But there's this, sad thing. It kind of makes me kind of, very feel sad inside when I see this kind of phenomenon. And, sometimes a selfing activity is not something we do alone, but whole societies help us to do it. It's a social construct also. So mine, the craving of possession, can take every possible form. We can take anything as mine. It can be, certainly it can be my possessions, my things that I own. And it happens very, very quickly and seemingly very innocently. Some of you, you're sitting here at IMC, you come here, you're sitting here, and then during the announcement time, you rush out to the bathroom, and you come back, and someone has showed up and sat in your place. what? That's my place. They took it. It wasn't yours 2 hours ago, and it's not going to be yours in 2 hours, but somehow in the process of coming to IMC, there's been this very somewhat subtle creative activity in your mind where you identify, this is my seat for this duration. And if someone has taken your seat, that could stir up all kinds of things in your mind. But there isn't any, perhaps no question about looking back at yourself, see how that creative activity has happened to begin with. As I like to say, if all of us left tonight in different shoes than we came with, our shoes wouldn't care. My shoes, that idea, that's a construction of our mind. It's an activity of the mind. The mind has to have this activity. That it's your shoes, is not inherent in the shoe itself. It's something that belongs to this world of social constructions, of thoughts and ideas. And then we engage in that. And some of you, especially if you have Birkenstocks, I've noticed, you can get quite upset coming to IMC and the Birkenstocks have been switched. I was once part of a three-way switch of Birkenstocks. Somehow I ended up with someone else's Birkenstocks, but we figured it out because we didn't know who the third person was, but we figured out that it was a three-way switch. There's this activity that happens very quickly. Mine, that's my seat. Or it happens slowly, builds up over time. And then there's, possession of, so there's things in the world we can take possession of. And also people to some degree. Some people possess people in ugly ways. And it could be terrible. But also there's taking possession of things inside of us. Taking, this is mine. So this is my body. This is my hair. This is my eyesight. This is my whatever. And to some degree, it's not like, my eyesight is someone else's eyesight. It makes some sense to say that. But we can kind of it's possible to crave, to have clinging, get caught by this, this is mine, for me, to take care of. So it's quite an insult then to my sense of mind, my body, when the body ages and changes. My face, this is my face. And then slowly the face begins to sag and get wrinkled and the teeth do funny things and those eyebrows kind of begin to sag a little bit, and you kind of try to lift them up and, there's all kinds of wonderful things people do. It's great. I saw some years ago in Palo Alto, I don't know if it's still there in business, probably still in business, I walked by, there was a plastic surgery place. And the place looked like it should be in Las Vegas or something. It was this beautiful palace kind of look. And I was, what's the image they were trying to portray about, plastic surgery? Just the facade of the place was plastic. So my, my beauty, my beauty. And then my beauty is something that, has to be carefully guarded. We can't go out into public unless we have my beauty is there. Oh, it's great. Almost better than Buddhist practice on some attachments is having kids. because like, you know, you think you have to be beautiful and well dressed and everything has to be fine and clean, and after you have kids, after, you know, a little baby especially, after kids, it's hopeless. You know, you show up and, you know, there's spit up on your shirt, and, you know, and you don't have time, you couldn't care, you know, you're too sleepy to care about your hair, and you know, it's the last thing you're concerned about is your beauty. It's great, you know, you'd let go. And but people who don't have kids have to practice a lot, you meditate a lot, in order to let go of some attachments. So my beauty, you know, or my intelligence, we take possession of, this is who I really am, I'm holding on to my intelligence. Or my virtue, my goodness, this is, you know, I'm holding on to my virtue and some kind of way. So there's all kinds of things, we take possession and think this is who I really am, but is it really our possession? Does it make sense that it can be something we use and something we care for, but is it something that we have to kind of claim, this is mine? Even something inside of ourselves, you know, part of our body or mind. I love the story of Suzuki Roshi, a Zen teacher, who held up his glasses like this for some students. And there was a photograph taken just as he was saying this. And he was holding up the glasses like this, and he said, "These glasses are not my glasses, but you know about my tired eyes, so you let me use them." That's nice. And then there is Tanisara Bhikkhu, who teaches here sometimes, and he says, yeah, your body is not yourself, it's not your possession, you know, it's not to hold on to and hold as your possession. However, while you're still kind of involved in this body, you should take care of it, at least as good as you take care of your car. You know, maintain it, and it has to be well maintained so it can really, you know, serve you on the spiritual path. And if you don't maintain it well, then so you take care of it, but you don't have to hold on, this is mine. I've known plenty of people who suffered dramatically because they've held on, you know, to their sense of control, their ability to control what they think is theirs and hold on to it and not let it go away when it naturally goes away or is taken away from them. So mine. So one of the reasons we're talking about all this, selfing, is not because it's philosophically interesting. That doesn't really interest me. But why we're talking about it is because there's a tremendous amount of suffering that arises because of people's activity of selfing. And you know, so I think you know, probably a big, huge percentage of people suffering has some connection to their selfing process. Because of the difficulty of defining self in Buddhism, I have kind of a shorthand definition of what self is, and Buddhist idea of self, or kind of cute the definition. And I call it, self is wind drag. Wind drag. Wind drag. You know, if you put your head out the window and it slows down the car, it's wind drag. The selfing is wind drag. You're creating wind drag. You're creating this extra baggage that just gets in the way. So the first one is the attachment to what we call mine. The activity of mining, making it a mine. The second is the activity of conceit, of defining myself primarily in relationship to other people or in contrast to other people. And so as many of you know, there are three forms of conceit in Buddhism. There's the conceit of seeing yourself as superior to others, which is quite common in English idea of conceit. There's the idea that you're less than others, you're inferior, and the idea that you're equal. Isn't that interesting? The equal also, all three are forms of conceit, because all three have to do with comparisons. You're comparing yourself, even you're equal to someone else, you're involved in comparing yourself to someone. And then you can ask, well, what's the alternative to those three? That's the three options, right? And the fourth option is you don't engage in that activity of comparing. There's no need to make yourself better, worse, or equal to. You just are, you know, and you know, just go along with how things are. So, so some of the things we take as mine can also be places where we define myself in relationship to others. So my beauty, my wealth, my status, my relationships, who I'm connected to, who my intelligence, many different things we take as being, this is who I am. And who I am is something that can create a tremendous amount of suffering. So, for example, the little story I like to say is when I was in junior high school, I noticed one day that I had a high forehead. And that wasn't good, having a high forehead. The whole thing about hair when I was a kid was such a big deal. I used to pull my hair a lot to see if I can get it grow longer. Because, you know, my friends had long hair, and I was wanting, you know, see if I can get it grow faster. And then there were split ends. You know, I had long hair, but they had to deal with split ends. And you know, all kinds of issues around here, boy. And and then how to braid it, and that was an issue also, you know, back in those days. But this high forehead thing, and so I spent an inordinate amount of time in my classes, because, you know, classes weren't that interesting, not much was going on. So I would, measuring the distance from the top of my nose to my hairline to make sure that it wasn't, you know, receding. That's interesting. Maybe it finally is. Because I had this way of measuring my fingers, you know. Because that was really important, right? It was such an important thing. And then there was when I went to my first junior high school dance. And it was okay. But until the end. And it was basically over, and we were all starting to leave, I guess. And my father walked across the gym floor to get me, to bring me home. I was mortified. Boy, that was so painful. I was so embarrassed. And so that's you know, I was involved in this selfing activity, you know, my sense of self, how I was seen, how I was seen in comparison to other people. It was all going on there. And of course, most of you are not teenagers anymore, so I imagine none of you are doing this kind of activity anymore. But what I should say is you're probably still doing it, but you've gotten more refined and sophisticated. The kind of things that were really, you know, grabbed your sense of self as a teen probably, you know, doesn't matter so much anymore. I mean, if you go out in the public with a pimple now, it doesn't really matter. Your hairline doesn't matter quite as much as it used to, and all kinds of things don't matter. And but now other things matter, perhaps. So so a tremendous amount of suffering exists in human life in this process of comparing self and others, much more than you probably realize. That your suffering has to do with comparing yourself to others. Better in some ways, better. Some ways you're worse than. Concerned that whole judgments and comparison. But it isn't just comparing ourselves to others, but also comparing ourselves to values and ideals. So we hold ideals. We should be a certain way, and we don't live up to them. Or sometimes we do live up to them, and then we kind of get attached to that. We hold on to that. And that can cause suffering also when we do live up to something. A kind of another way of taking a self-identity, another example, this is who I am, is when I was in seventh grade, I had an art class. And we were supposed to draw something. I was drawing my left hand. And for the first time in my life, I noticed that there were all these little lines, teeny little creases all over the hand, you know, thousands of them, teeny, teeny little wrinkles. No idea that they had too many wrinkles or whatever. No, they may not wrinkles, they're called little lines. So I got fascinated with those, so I started drawing them all in. And the art teacher came over and said to me, "Oh, you have no artistic talent." Now, no, you shouldn't laugh at something like that, right? It's so terrible. I mean, can you imagine telling a seventh grader that? Now, I didn't care. I had no investment at all in being an artist or being good at art. I couldn't care less. It didn't hurt me at all. However, I believed her. She was the authority. So I went through the rest of school believing that I, you know, this is who I was. I'm someone who doesn't have any artistic ability. So that was, you know, my sense of self was created. It was an activity. It was a view. It was co-created with this teacher. And then in freshman year in college, my roommate was a born-again artist. And, you know, which meant that everyone should be an artist. And so... I was his roommate. So in various ways, he kind of tricked me into, you know, drawing. And it turned out I had some talent, a little bit of talent for it, and enough so that I started enjoying it a lot. And I started taking art classes and drawing classes. And in order to take more drawing classes at the university, you had to be an art major. So I became an art major. You know, imagine. I know I had no intention of majoring in art, but it was a way of taking those classes. And so it was all great. I had lots of fun. Drawing, painting, it was lots of fun. And then the glorious day happened where I decided, I am an artist. Mm. And the amazing thing, it's kind of hard to believe how amazing this is, but the day I identified myself, who I am an artist, was the day I stopped doing art. Mm. And in part, I think it was because then I had to do art in order to fulfill the identity, to prove the identity somehow. And somehow that wasn't motivating enough. I couldn't do it for that reason. Somehow I froze, or I don't know what happened. And it took many, many years. It wasn't until I was at the Zen monastery that I started doing some art again. Somehow the Zen training kind of opened something in me that allowed me to for that to flow again. So, you know, we think I'm an artist. And that could be innocent. Some of you might be artists. But we can, it's possible to cling to that, and it can cause all kinds of suffering. You have to prove yourself, or if you make bad art, then you know your identity is tied with that. Your sense of self is tied to that. There was this movie, probably some of you maybe saw, called Dead Poets Society. And in there's a scene where Robin Williams takes these boys outside in a courtyard, and he has them all walking around. And then he teaches them basically, you should all walk in your own individual way. So that's a great American ideal, you know, be your own person, being an individual, just walk your own way. But that's also kind of a selfing activity, you know, to create your own individual sense of self has a great value in America. But why should you go to extra trouble? You know, to prove yourself and to be someone special. I mean, everyone's special just the way they are. And so that's a whole selfing activity of being an individual and standing out and being unique. Or there's a selfing activity and not being unique, being equal to everyone else and not, you know, standing out. When I was in Hawaii going to college there was a very strong Confucian ethic in Hawaiian society because of the Japanese and Chinese influence there. And one of the sayings that was talked about in class was kind of Chinese sayings is, the nail that stands up gets hammered down. And it was quite remarkable to see the degree to which many of the students in the college classes there did not want to excel, did not want to show that they were kind of really good. And you know, you wanted to be just kind of like good, but you didn't want to kind of stand out because it was dangerous to stand out. And they talked about it. It wasn't something that was, you know, something that a Haole kind of judged from the outside, but some, you know, how at least someone from the mainland. And so they were trying to construct a kind of self that's kind of fits in more, is harmonious. So every society, you know, has these values that go people try to figure out so they can construct the right kind of self that fits in there. And I suspect we have it right here in IMC, that we have a certain kind of ethos, a certain kind of flavor that people, sometimes it's projection, but sometimes maybe, you know, oh, we have to go. Some guys told me recently, oh, I've been coming here for years, and it seemed like everyone's so kind of reverent and dour. You know, so I don't know, is that how we appear? And so, you know, he thought maybe you have to be that kind of person to be here, reverent and dour. Well, I hope that's not, you know, I like irreverence, so. Anyway, so we have it here too, you know, so people come here and say, how am I supposed to be here? What kind of self am I supposed to be here? These people here, you know, these Buddhist types, you know, what do they want? What's the right Buddhist kind of person to be? And so we try to figure out, you know, oh, that kind of cushion. I have to get that kind of cushion because, you know, then I'm a good self, good Buddhist self. And what kind of clothes you wear, you know? I can't wear those, you know, really wild, colorful clothes at IMC because Buddhist is supposed to be kind of, you know, dull. So it's a view, it's an idea, it's a selfing. So the third selfing activity is the clinging, what's called craving to views. Okay? And this has to do with a view or an opinion about what the essential self is, the essential soul, who I am in essence. So all the others, you know, the second one of who I am as myself, the conceit part, often exists in comparison to others, in relationship to others. It's something where you are unique in some kind of way. The view of a self, of who I really essential am, is something that's more universal. This is what a human being is like. A human being is this essential. This is what a human being is really like. This is the essence. And the essence of a human being is this way. So it's not. So it's a philosophy or a view as opposed to something that's unique to you. And so, for example, you know, in America, we might have this view of individualism, that you know, we're autonomous individual selves. That's so important. That's a view. And we kind of assume that's true for everyone. And it's not true in some societies. That's not the view of a human being. They have a very different idea of a human being and how a human being should be. And they create a different kind of idea, social idea of what a self is. The autonomous self is not so interesting or not really relevant or not really something. It's very interesting that here in America, where the idea of autonomous individual is a value that's held up to a high degree, is among American and Western Buddhist teachers who grew up in the culture of this individualism, they teach ten times, a hundred times, a thousand times more the teaching of interdependence than you find in Thailand or India or traditionally in Buddhism. You know, so because if people feel so autonomous, you know, they have to be reminded, we're not so autonomous. You have to realize that you're not so separate. And that's really important, because it actually becomes an important mystical experience for people here in the West to realize that, you know, it's not so separate. We're all connected. It makes some sense if you've been inculcated with a strong sense of it being an individual, that you need that kind of teaching. In Japan, where the sense of a social self is so strong, where there, you know, you're not an individual, you're part of an organism, that's the society or the family. There, if you become a Buddhist monk, the understanding is, it's a really radical act in Japan, where you're stepping outside of your normal social context. You're really leaving it. And once you've left it in Japan, it's very hard to step back in. But here in America, you know, I was ordained as a Buddhist monk, as a Buddhist priest. I have lots of ordinations. And all I have to do is let my hair grow out again and put on a suit and tie, and I can, you know, no one cares about my past that way. But in Japan, it's very hard to get back in again once you've chosen to sever those connections. So the idea of being, you know, there, of being, we're all interconnected. I suspect that among some Japanese Buddhists, they just put him asleep, or it's not interesting, that teaching. Because that's already, they're aware of that all too well. So there's ideas of, original sin. Isn't it a view that has to do with creating a certain selfing, certain activity, that this is who I really am. Or the idea of original, goodness. In the modern world, modern West, a lot of people like to believe the opposite of original sin, where originally beautiful. There's original goodness inside of us. That's another view. And sometimes people like to see that coming out of Buddhism, and Buddhism teaches that there's original goodness in all of us. But that's also a view. This is who I am. I am really inherently good, my essence. It's like, you know, it's like putting veneer over. It's a belief. It's a view. Is it necessary to have that view? Is it necessary to live and see ourselves through an opinion, through a view? Is there an alternative? Why do we need to? Why are we engaged in the selfing activity? What are we trying to fulfill? What are we trying to prove? What are we trying to accomplish through it? So we construct a view about who we essentially are, and then we live based on that view, often without questioning it. So as people meditate, sooner or later, often later, the mind will begin to quiet down. And quiet down means that the activity of the mind begins to quiet down. So, you know, if you are really agitated about something that big happened today at work, the mind maybe is going in 10,000 miles an hour and going this way and that way, and after 45 minutes sitting, maybe that all those concerns settle down and the mind's not thinking about what happened earlier today so much. You're still thinking some, but what happened at work is kind of distant memory for a few minutes, because all that activity of the mind is quieted down. So it's possible to quiet the activity, the thinking mind, more and more and more. And as the thinking mind, as the activity of the mind quiets down, becomes more tranquil, we're going to sooner or later reach these levels in the mind where certain very pervasive, almost constant, but semi-conscious or unconscious or subconscious activity of selfing is operating. So you might not know that you have a view about, you know, I am essentially an inadequate person. That's who I am. And, you know, that's the nature of the universe. Inherent in the universe is the fact that I was born as an inadequate, unworthy person. That's a view. That's a selfing. So Buddhism say that's not inherent in the universe or inherent in you. That's a view. It's a story that the mind made. And so in that it's a story, you have to be telling yourself the story in order for it to be operating. So there's a storytelling level of the mind. And so maybe at some point you're no longer thinking about all the things that happen at work and about all the plans you have to do for the future, and the mind gets quieter and quieter. At some point you come to this level where you're telling yourself this story about your adequacy or inadequacy. And when you do, then you can start questioning that. Not necessarily whether it's true or false, which you can get into a quagmire if you're questioning is it true or false. Am I really inadequate? Maybe I'm not. I should do positive thinking. All kinds of things you can do. But what you can do instead is you can just quiet that activity. Don't engage in it. Don't try to fix it in terms of in its own language. Just relax that activity of the mind, just like you would relax a muscle. You don't have to be engaged in it. While you're meditating, you don't have to engage in that kind of activity. It can be very hard to let go of certain stories we tell ourselves, certain views, because they're often, you don't even see them as storytelling, you see them as a pervasive mood or an emotional state. But that sometimes, some of our emotions, especially our more, what's called sometimes negative emotions, are closely connected to stories we're telling ourselves of selfing, stories of selfing activity. So, to begin quieting the activity and looking deeper and deeper. And so you can't really get to really deep peace unless some way or other you're willing to put to rest some of the selfing activity that the mind is engaged in. It's not an easy thing to do. Sometimes it's a frightening thing to do, to let go of that security and that reference we normally have, this is who I am. But to quiet the activity down so we can get to some really deep, deep potential of peace that is there when the activity is not always so busy and engaged. So here the challenge is not the challenge of philosophy. Is there or is there not a self? It's a challenge of going from an agitated state to an increasingly peaceful state. And what are you willing to let go of, at least temporarily, to get experience that kind of peace? And, you know, you're welcome to pick up yourself again at the end of the meditation. But at least in meditation, can you put it up on the shelf and let yourself sink into a deep level of peace? One of the advantages of doing that is that if you can experience a sense of well-being that is not tied to any selfing activity or your normal selfing activity, that's going to change your relationship to selfing activity. You're not going to be so invested in it because it's not going to seem so important. Because you know a sense of well-being is not dependent on, you know, being a certain way, or being a certain kind of person. One of the inspiring people in my life was my great-grandmother, who I was lucky enough to know, and I lived with her for a short while in her little apartment. And a little tenement apartment in Norway where she lived. And she had a little spare bedroom I stayed in, and she had this little living room with all this lace, you know, lace over the tables. And she sat in this chair most of the day. And she didn't talk very much, though she was quite lucid. And sometimes I just like to go into the little living room with her and all the lace and stuff, and just sit there and sit with her and just be in her aura, be in the atmosphere she created around her. And I didn't really know her that well, so maybe I was projecting. But what I felt when I sat with her was, here was a person who didn't have to be anything for anybody. You know, she's an old woman, she'd done everything, she had all these kids and husband and gone through all this stuff in life, gone through two world wars and all kinds of activities. And she had nothing to prove, no one to be, no one, nowhere to go. And she sat there very content and very peaceful. And to be in the presence of something so peaceful and content, not needing to prove anything or defend anything or show it who they were, just to be. Just being was enough. It was so inspiring. And then when I started meeting great Dharma practitioners, I started recognizing some of them had the same quality. They can just be them. We say in English, they can just be themselves. Or some people say they just could be. But we can say that they could just be without needing to engage in all this complicated selfing that it seems to be the currency of exchange among human beings. And I would recommend that you go down to the local bank and trade that currency in for something better. And peace, inner well-being is much better than the whole selfing enterprise. Okay, so I hope that beginning to make the whole selfing thing in Buddhism a little bit easier to understand. If it didn't make it easier, then I didn't prepare this talk.
Thank you.